I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. Hey, gang. So, our show here is sponsored by the wonderful 750, which is a search and find pricing database for wholesale buyers in New York and New Jersey, which we love very much. But we found a few other people who love it too, one of whom is the fabulous Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, who's here today.
Hey guys, so I buy for a lot of different random wines, and I love to use 750 because there's a lot of great smaller wholesalers on there that you can take a look at. And as Garth Algar would say from Wayne's World, live in the now. Use 750 because it's great. And it's wonderful for those liquor buyers and wine buyers out there.
Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, a user of the 750 service. Thank you. David Chappelle on the show. Hello, sir. How are you?
Yeah, fine. And you?
Welcome. Welcome to New
Welcome.
York.
Yeah, thank you. My first time here.
So you are the son of Alain Chappelle,
yes,
the Michelin
the oldest.
three-star chef from Lyon, and he died in 1990. But what are your memories of your dad?
Yeah, you know, when he died, I was 9, so only a few images, but always in the restaurant. He sometimes cooked for my brother and I, and a few tasting with winemakers, but I was at that time only tasting, not drinking.
Well, still, those are probably some good wines that you were
Yeah,
getting exposed to at a young age.
just for smelling, it was in a way the beginning of my history with wine and food.
And
It's the way you teach your kids something like that.
did he seem like a very intense man?
I think, yeah.
And
But I don't have a big memory, but he was, stressed in a way by his work and thinking about the next step or the next dish or what he can found, like products or wine or people.
so you are in a little town outside of Lyon.
Yes, Mionnet.
And what was that like? I mean, who would come in the door?
At that time, three-star restaurants, you have local from Lyon and French people, and but also like three-star restaurants, foreigners from Europe, the States, Japan, all around the world. People came just for have a lunch or a dinner.
And your dad was really associated with Nouvelle Cuisine. Is that something that seems to make sense for you, or what? How would you sum up the style of your father's cooking?
Yeah, at that time, like three or four guys like him were associated to the Nouvelle Cuisine. It's the main thing is like just like a few years before he started, there was like much more big dishes, plates in the middle of the table, and then a service like Russian service or, and then my father and other people, cookers like him, start to do it only in a plate. So, and he start like he said like not more than three products in one plate. After it's too much or, and he was known and what in a way make his him successful was he was always trying to find the best product, the freshest product, the small producer. It was the same with wine.
He had strong relationships with vintners in the area.
With winemakers and also producers like vegetables and meat, he tried to have a huge contact in near in Brittany, with the fishermen, so he can order the best fish they can have.
Because in Lyon, there's not a lot of fish like in
Yeah,
Lyon.
only non-salt, only non-salt water, like in lakes, like in France, Lac Léman, very popular, a nice fish, Homble Chevalier, very nice. So it's the closest.
And your dad had developed some strong ties with winemakers and vintners in the area, wine growers.
Yes, of course.
And who are some of the people that were on the list at that time?
If we talk about Burgundy, like Henri Jaillet and Pierre Ramonet, he was very close to Pierre Ramonet. Then Hubert de Monti, Le Domaine also, Marquis d'Angerville, Lafon, Roumier. All now it's big names. At that time it was very good wines, names, but not as, in a way, famous and expensive than it is now.
Because this would have been the 80s, basically.
Yeah. And also like Ravno was very close. And more close to Mionnet, Marcel Lapierre in Beaujolais and Pierre Auvernois also in Jura. And you know, Jura wine, even now, it's the name is famous. The wines are very good, but it's not as famous as it could be or should be for me.
And your dad would cook to those wines, make dishes for those wines?
Well, yeah. He was very interested like that, you know, cooking a dish in relation to the wine.
And did you have like special dinners where people would come in and show their wines and he would make meals? Or did you do like wine dinners? Or
Yeah. He started like a year before his death, just a private dinner with winemaker. It was just friends, you know, not for business or anything. And he set up a dinner, like even on Mondays, day off, just to have to show the winemakers what he was cooking and doing, and just to enjoy a nice party. So winemakers bring wine, and my father cooking very nice, you know, big truffle dinner and small birds and nice dinners and huge wine list.
Are you saying at 8 years old you were eating ortolan? Is that what you're saying?
I was seven the first time. And my father cooked it, and my grandmother at that time learned my brother and I how to eat it, you know, with a towel under your head.
Why do they do the towel over the head?
Yeah, just to keep the flavor only for you. Other people don't have to share it with you. Like, it's, you know, it's selfish in a way. That's the purpose.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
because, you know, here, so it's illegal. So I always thought, like, people wanted not to have their picture taken, you know?
It's also illegal in France now.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Now, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're endangered now or something?
Yeah, no, there is a lot of birds who are, in a way, illegal in France. But it's, you can have it in Switzerland, in Belgium, or in Monaco.
Oh, you can?
Yeah.
So it's like pot in Amsterdam. You can go.
Yeah.
Or
yeah, same.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh. The things you learn on the podcast. Excellent.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, though, your dad had more than just a professional relationship with these vintners, that they were also his friends.
Yeah, like, yeah, much more. It's not for business or not in order to have more wine. Don't care. He had all the wine he wants, you know, like at that time with quite everybody, and even Henri Jaillet, you know, at that time, a guy like Henri Jaillet was making wine, selling it, but those people like sell their wine to people with interest in the wine, but you know, it's a face-to-face deal in a way. So they were just putting crosses on barrels. So I mean, it means that this barrel is for you, this one. It was embottled from this barrel to my father.
Is that because its name was Chapel? Is that why it was a cross? Was that like
a
church association?
Yeah, no meaning. But it's, you know, during tasting on barrels, say, oh, I really like this one. So, okay, I put it for you. You select it before.
Do you still have any of that wine, may I ask?
In private cellars, we still have some orange.
Amazing. So I know where I'm visiting next time. So, unfortunately, your dad did die at a relatively young age, in his 50s. He had a stroke or heart attack.
Heart attack,
While he was opening a restaurant, I believe, in Florida.
Oh, no. He was on holidays in the south of France.
Oh, okay.
But I know that he used to have a business relation with an hotel in San Francisco. It was maybe in the early 80s. But he stayed over there like 1 or 2 years, not more, I think. They say at that time it was difficult to find good staff. So he was in a way scared of that.
In the States.
Yeah. And so, because in a way, you know, he was not here every day to to teach and to manage people. So it was, in a way, I think, and because I don't really know the story, I think he was scared of what may happen while he was not here.
And he had some amazing staff work for him in France, like Michel Roux.
A lot of chef now, or three-star chef, was part of his crew, team.
And people have talked about, like Heston Blumenthal has talked about being influenced by him.
Alain Ducasse was also in Mionnet a lot, yeah.
And so what was the family situation subsequent to his death with the restaurant? I mean, where did things stand from 1990,
1991? My mother took over then. And at that time, the second, I don't know in English how you said it, second, the sous chef in a way of my father, the chef, was Philippe Jousse. So my mother, at that time he was in Japan, you know, taking care of the restaurant my brother opened over there. And my mother asked him if he want to come back to Mionnet and just take the job.
She asked Philippe if he wanted to
come back. Yeah, and Philippe stayed till we closed with my brother 2 years ago.
And you also spent some time in Japan, is that?
3 years, yeah.
What was that like?
I really enjoyed the country, the food, people. It was a very nice stay. I will come back. I will go back, but for holidays or, I don't know, maybe one time to open a restaurant, I don't know.
And where were you located?
In Kobe.
Oh, so that's Kansai good for area. Someone from Lyon who likes beef, huh?
Yeah, beef. And the Kansai is very nice. Like, you can go visiting Kyoto, and it's, in a way, less busy than Tokyo in terms of inhabitants, and it's more countryside in a way. But there is like 2 million people in Kobe, so it's quite big. But for Japan, you feel you're... In like 10 minutes, you're in the forest, so it's very nice.
And they seem to be very receptive to the French cuisine.
Yes. Like a century ago, Kobe was very... The port of Kobe was very important with the tradings of products from Europe and worldwide products. But in a way, it stopped in 95 with the big earthquake. So the business moved to Osaka.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And did that affect the restaurant that you had there, that your family had there?
Yeah, the only, you know, broken plates, but it's in a big hotel and strongly built, so not to break. So
and
nobody was injured.
That must have been in a time where it was probably easier to get staff working for you than it would have been in the States in the 80s, because there's so many young Japanese cooks who are interested in French food.
Yeah, I think, and my father was quite happy with the Japanese staff he found over there. They wanted to learn, and it's very Japanese also, you know, you listen, you do, and then do the same way. Sometimes they do it too much the same way, but... And at that time, my father sent some of his guys to take care of the kitchen. So there is always one or two or three staff in service and in the kitchen.
And what were you looking after when you were working there?
I was like 24, 25 to travel and discover a country and to enjoy a...
But
another
you
country.
Were also working in a restaurant?
Yes, yes. In the service.
In the service, front of the house.
Yeah.
Like a waiter or captain?
Yes. I was assisting the manager.
So did that give you some more exposure to wine at that time in terms of your own development with wine?
Yeah, of course. And also, like, I have my image of wine and what you can drink while eating and how much you can drink. But it was funny to see, you know, a different culture, how people drink and how much, the price. It's also like that, a country and how far you can go with Japanese people.
What was the difference between the way that people approach wine in Kobe than they had in Lyon?
I think Japanese people are much more like receptive to teaching. you say, oh, you should drink that with food. In France now, too much people think they know everything. So, okay, they say, no, I want to drink that, even if you think it's not a good match. But so you say, okay, drink that if you want that. Japanese people will more listen to you to advise. A sommelier or a waiter is, in a way, or a maître d'hôtel or sommelier is, in a way, here not to just to take plates or to open bottles. It's here to advise, and I think it's that.
Was Burgundy very popular at the time?
Yeah, much more. I think in the 80s, like in every country, Bordeaux was like Champagne very popular. But then when a country opens up to wine or wine industry, in a way, they go after to Burgundy. And like it's the same, it happened in the same way in the US. Or if now you go to Asia, like in Hong Kong, it was very popular with Bordeaux, but now it's all about Burgundy. There is so much different. First, you have white and red, which Bordeaux, there is not that much of white. White and reds and different climates and so much to learn and so much differences. With only two kind of grapes, there is so much. So people who want to learn or want to discover, you always discover something in Burgundy.
So after the 3 years in Kobe, what did you do next? What happened for you after that?
I came back to the restaurant. At that time, my brother, in a way, finished his trip all around France in restaurants. He was in kitchen with Philippe. So I say, okay, shall we do something like a renewal or, you know, to add another family member, in a way, to the restaurant.
Because the restaurant was still doing well. It had 2 stars, Michelin.
Yeah, 2 stars. Yeah, we lost it one a year after my father's death.
And your brother had gone into kitchens and done stages in different parts of France.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He started to work in Brittany. A friend of my father who had a Michelin star restaurant in Pont-Aven, you know, very beautiful village. And also this chef was, in a way, my father link with fishermen's.
I see.
He worked here for like 1 year. Then he worked with Rollinger. At that time, he had 2 stars. Then he go to Alsace at Illhausen, Eberlin family, 3 stars. Then he worked in Mionnet for 1 year. He goes south to Jacques Maximin's restaurant in Vence. Then he have a year break in wine. Like he work at Marcel Lapierre place in winter, only for shaping the vines. He went for 2 or 3 months in Chile. I have a friend. We have a friend who is a winemaker in Chile. Then he came back and spent the rest of the year working with Thierry Almond and Jean-Louis Chave.
I've heard of them.
And then he come back to the restaurant in Mionnet.
Because in a way, that's not too far away from Corna or from Morgon. Like it's half
hour. Oh, no, yeah, yeah. From our place, you go to Jean-Louis Chave's place or Thierry Almond, like 1 hour and 30 minutes for Beaujolais.
And so you went back and you said to your brother, what should we do with the restaurant? And how did that discussion go?
We first, you know, it was in the kitchen. I was in service. So when I came back from Japan, it was April or May. So I just entered the service staff in a way to till the end of the year, till December. And then in January, it's our month's holidays.
So the restaurant closes.
Yeah, okay. The restaurant closed for a month. We say, what shall we do with, you know, in a way, prices, the menu, bigger or smaller, or, you know, try to do something. That's why, and we wanted to refresh the menu, to give something different to people. After 20 years, it was needed to, you know, to reboost.
Because your dad is associated with certain famous dishes that stayed on the menu past
yeah,
his
we,
death.
Yeah, we keep those dishes. But then, you know, he was always creating some dishes. Some works, some other do not works, but always giving, you know, at that time he do 4 cartes a year, like seasonal. But in one season, you can do a lot of dishes.
And so, your dad had been open to kind of using more Asian ingredients, probably because of the relationship with Japan, a little bit earlier than some French chefs.
He used some, at that time, in a way, IDs, a few products, but not that much. You know, he was not making, for me, Japanese-style cuisine, but for his trip, like he used like tempura just for an appetizer or one dish, the style of tempura, which, by the way, come from Portugal. The Japanese don't create it. It's a Portuguese guy who bring it to Japan. So it's, in a way, European. So you always, and, you know, country you have visited or for history, by the history, you got the sailors or merchants. So there is always spices or different kind of cooking.
So that you got a little bit more involved in wine and during your time back at the restaurant with your brother?
Yes, I was in service and then also helping the sommelier. And then the year after, the sommelier, who was also having, in a way, his small business in wine, you know, we have a discussion and he decided to, you know, to go and only take care of his business. So I say, okay, so I take the sommelier job, taking care of the cellar and buyings and it works like same in the US by allocations. So we have a lot of allocations from the winemakers. So every year you ship, you get your allocation. So, and then, but you find new winemakers or by tasting or by meeting, by.
So your family had really strong connections with different Burgundian
producers, different Rhone producers, and Champagne.
And at the same time, you were traveling around to taste in the cellars with.
Yeah, always in day off. Not, you know, and most of the time it was not really for, you know, buying wine, but just to have fun, tasting and eating with winemakers. It's. We are close, and in a way, it's a good thing, just for eating and drinking.
Which is something your dad used to do.
You told. Yeah, he used to do that. Yeah,
go on his day off and hang with Marcel.
Yeah,
Lapierre, and
yeah, just to have fun and casual way, not for business. You do business, but you eat and you drink, and then you come back with wine, or you say, okay, I want that, and you have it delivered.
So eventually, not too long ago, the restaurant did close. You made the decision with your family to close Alain Chapelle, the restaurant.
Yeah.
And how did that affect you? I mean, what were your feelings around that?
For me, it's, in a way, I don't have the feeling to betray or something like that. You know, we have an history. Recipes, know-how, everything. My brother have it. He have the same, you know, feelings and as my father, I think. So, in a way, we just postpone a new open or. But it was much more like the place was no more good for business and too much investment were needed. And with my brother, we had this discussion and say, do you want to be here in 50 years? And the first answer was no. So it's just postponing. And, you know, like to reopen something. Or right now, my brother is chef for Pierre Gagnaire in London. He'll stay over there like 2 or 3 years. It's good for him to improve his English and... It's a big building, so there, you know, for management position, it's good also for him. He's 30 years old to learn. He know how to cook, but it's also know how to do business with people. So, and he, you keep it for you. But I think he's going to be a three-star chef. He's very good. I believe in him, so.
I mean, I think one of the things about Gagnard, at least the food I've eaten from him, is that he's very good at translating a personal vision onto the plate and making that commercially successful.
My brother think that. You give him two or three or four products, and he like in 30 seconds, most of chefs or big chefs are like that. In 30 seconds, they build something. They create a dish. Then they will maybe readapt or change a few things. But in 30 seconds, like it's an automatism, he creates something. And he says he's very good at that. So it's good for him to share this.
So your brother went in that direction with the kitchen in London. And then what have you decided to do? What have you been up to since the restaurant?
As I said, I'm close to winemakers, and I decided, in a way to have a year break. So I went to Beaujolais, Mathieu Lapierre, who is now running the domain. He's a friend. So just before, we had a few drinks and dinners, and he said, if you want to come here. So I take a year break working in the vines and in the cellar, and to refresh my mind and be... don't think about anything about restaurants, or just to have fun and discover, in a way, wine, but how you do it, how you deal with it. And
you started in 2012 there in Morgon?
Yes, in April last year.
And that was a particularly rainy year, I believe.
2012, was quite rainy, and you got to be very careful with the vines to do something with the millésime. It's not the easiest millésime of the century.
So maybe that was a kind of trial by fire for you, in a way, to start in a particular... Yeah,
it's
difficult.
Very good for learning and to see how people deal with the weather, with earth. Because wine, like now, every year, some winemakers or some critics say it's the millésime of the century. This is a... No, you gotta see what happened in the pitch, in the field. The weather sometimes, like in Beaujolais, 09, 10, and 11 were nice, in quantity, very different. But winemakers had something. So then 2012 reminds you that it's also the earth who decide. After you got to be careful and do your best with what you add.
Because I don't think it's the millésime of the century sometimes so much as the century of millésimes. Like each one is very different. A hundred different vintage. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. It's a very, I like it. It's very light. And in Beaujolais, it's like that. It's not a bodybuilding man. It's very light. It's an, in a way, an aperitif for a... You can have it for, we are joking with Mathieu sometimes, it's also for breakfast if you want. It's like...
Well, you can in France where they eat meat for breakfast. Yeah. Here it's a little more difficult with the Wheaties.
Yeah.
But,
it's an image, so you... It's for having an aperitif time with friends, it's good. This kind of white wine, red wine, sorry.
So, I mean, this is an estate that has a lot of associations with working naturally, working in tune with nature. Sort of the Marcel, Matthew's father, was kind of one of the founding fathers of the what's known as the Gang of Four of Morgon, Foyard, Thévenet. So how did they respond to 2012? What did you see as you're, working with them in the vines? What was the techniques used?
You spend much more time in the vines. To take care with, like with treatment, you add more because like in every vines, you treat, but if there is too much rain, the action in a way disappear. So you got to do it again.
Oh, so if there's rain, it can wash away the treatment.
Yeah.
And you have to...
Too much rain wash away the treatment.
And when you say treatment, you don't mean pesticides so much.
No, it's the way they work. It's in a way biological and biodynamics way. So if it's easier, it wash away easily. So you got to do it again.
So in terms of the different biodynamic treatments where you might say, for example, most famously bury a horn, that kind of thing, they had to do those multiple times because of the rains.
Yeah, yeah. So you got to be very careful. And those guys are very stressed during starting like from April to August. Because then in August, you cannot do more. The harvest come in September and it's finished, you know, for treatment, and you just have to wait.
Did they give you some sort of number as, you know, what they normally do in terms of treatments, in terms of how quantity and what they had to do in 2012?
In a way, they double. It was double or more, three times more treatment.
So in many senses, it's much more labor intensive to work.
Yeah, also.
That's actually not going to sell for more. It's going to sell for less, maybe.
Yeah. You know? So it costs a lot to producer, but it's the way you if you don't do that, you don't have any grapes and no wine. So you got to invest your time and labor force and products to do something with the millesime.
Has Matthew shared with you his thoughts on low sulfur versus sulfur at bottling, or some of the aspects of the winery that are really associated with the developments his father put in and his carrying those on? Do you feel like it's the same?
Yeah, well, it's the same. But and you know, if you take Domaine Lapierre, everything is written on the bottle. So you know, it's if there is sulfites added when they embottled or no, like for in the US or for much more for the export and big bottles, there is always a bit of sulfites added just to keep it, because without, you got to be careful. But it's also the customer have to take care of the bottle then. But some sellers or people don't have the right condition to keep the wine. So then after they say, the wine is, there is a problem with the wine. Not sometimes it could happen, but most of the time the problem comes from the way it was stocked.
And has there been a change in reception since the time that you were maybe a sommelier or a younger man to the Beaujolais crews like Morgon, either in France or on the export markets? Has it gotten more popular?
I know that the wine is popular now in foreign countries, and it's for example for Mathieu Lapierre, there is a big part of export, like in the US there is only one importer, but he imports a lot, but also Japan and quite every country worldwide, northern country of Europe imports quite a lot. It's interesting, but it's, you know, I think much more like much more sales in the export than Marcel. But at that time, Marcel, in a way, pushed doors. He traveled a lot to please taste my wine and do professional festivals and fairs. So now Mathieu is, in a way, harvesting a Marcel job, and he is doing more to open doors in more countries and improve this wine, the quality of the wine and the relation with people.
What about in the French market? You said that your dad had been one of the first 3-star restaurants to list Lapierre wine on his wine list.
Yeah.
Is it more or less common today than it was then to list a wine like Lapierre at the high-end restaurant level?
Yeah, there is much more high-level restaurants who have Marcel, but also other producers from Beaujolais. And there is a lot, and a big part of the business is also with bistro and, you know, in a way, much more casual restaurants. A lot in Paris. Paris drink a lot of Beaujolais, of Morgon.
Because there was a tradition for a long time of Lyon drinking a lot of Beaujolais in cafes and bistros, often with like tripe or beef dishes. Is that still current today, or is that different today?
Yeah, it's in a way, when this kind of Beaujolais crisis happened, the Côte du Rhône take the place. Somehow Beaujolais is fighting back to be in Lyon, in Bouchon, and like, you know, the the table wine was Beaujolais. It became Côte du Rhône. It is needed to be Beaujolais again. I think it's better.
And what are the wines that Lapierre is making? There's the Raison.
Raisin Gaulois.
There's the Morgon.
The Morgon.
Multiple bottlings with the sulfites or not. And then there's the Cuvée Marcel.
Yeah, but this cuvée is only when it's a good year. So, for example, there is nothing on 2012.
So you didn't see any of that?
No.
You didn't make any
no
Cuvée
chance.
Marcel
If you see a Cuvée Marcel in 2012, don't drink it. It's fake one.
And no such thing as a white Lapierre or...
No, or other cru, no.
And so how many hectares are they farming at this time?
15.
And is it all owned or are there...
15 are owned, yeah.
And are they buying in grapes as well for other projects or no?
Sometimes it can happen if for like 2012 you work with some guys who work that when you buy it's a year or much more longer relationship, so the owner work the way you want, like for treatment and also, sorry, I don't know the English for this world, you know, when you return the earth.
Sure, like plowing.
Okay.
Or not, you know. When or cover crops, maybe.
Yeah. Do not using a pesticide for killing grass, but only by with tools.
Kind of using mulch.
Yeah.
And we heard a lot here in this country about potential closings of Beaujolais producers in subsequent to the 2012 harvest. What do you see on the ground working there? Are people closing their doors, or who is it that's closing their doors, or is that not happening?
Right now, I didn't really see any effects, but it's true that last year's the local government in the way was saying, yeah, it's not a good year, so maybe a lot of producers will close. Those kind of, we're talking about people who, for like 90% of them, are only selling hectoliters to big negotiant. They don't embottle or have their own business in a way. So they are, they depend on the market. And for 2012, at the beginning, they say it was a very low price for hectoliters. But then there is no good wine, not more grapes. So the prices go up. So I think most of them were quite safe, but it's about the quantity they sell. So I don't really know yet. Maybe we'll see the effect next year.
And what has 2013 looked like in terms of working so far in the vines?
The working is good, but like you know, this year is also strange in France. It was it's in a way a bit rainy, but quite cold. Even now, by the end of May, so the vine is, in a way, holding the way it grow.
So it's the growth is not as much as it normally would be.
Yes, yes.
How far back are we talking about?
Maybe now, like 3 weeks.
So normally, what you would see in terms of vine growth, in terms of size and maturity, would be 3 weeks. Further than it is.
Yeah, right now it's like that. But you know, after if June and the summer, the sun is here, the vine will take the place. So it was same last year. On May, people say, "Oh, we will harvest by the end of September or October," but then the nature took back its place. So it was by the middle of September.
But there was snow recently in Burgundy.
Yes, in Burgundy, May. And yeah, it's in everywhere in the mountains and Burgundy. So it's quite too cold right now. So the vine is holding.
Has it made it hard to work the vines themselves because of the level of dampness and the soil?
The level of what?
Water in the soil.
Okay. Yeah, it's difficult for if you use engines, for example, because you can be stuck in
tractors.
Yeah, tractors. Yeah,
it's difficult for the tractors because they compress the soil and they can get stuck into the mud.
Yes, in the mud. Yeah, but by hand, it's no problem, you know.
Oh, so maybe less of an issue for Lapierre than some because of the way that you work.
Yeah. So, and there is always, you know, some gaps during without any rain or so you can go and work to cut the grass, you know, to, I forget the name of, you know.
Plowing, I think. Well, okay. But do you do that every row or do you do it every other row or how often do you plow at the vines at Lapierre?
It depends of, you know, the season and the size of the grass and how it's needed, but at least two times.
And are there
now and then during the summer?
I see.
Three times, four times if the guys have time and if the weather is okay.
Are there? I'm sorry.
But then Mathieu always have a kind of team. During the summer, like 8 or 10 people who go on every vines and by hand cut the grass near the sap.
Oh, near the base of the vine.
The base of the vine. Yeah.
Mm. And are there specific cover crops planted, or is it more just what grows there by itself? Like, have they planted certain things in between the rows?
Oh no.
So just
nothing.
Natural.
Yeah. It's
just
natural. Yeah.
What happens? And. Now that you've worked there for a bit and you've tasted a bit of Lapierre for several years and you grew up in that area, how would you compare Lapierre stylistically to other producers of Morgon? I mean, how do you place it in your own mind in terms of the taste?
Odd question. it's a good question, but to compare, I don't really like to compare people.
But is there a certain dish that you might have with Lapierre that you would have a different dish for Foyard? Let me put it that way. Like, when might you reach for Lapierre or Chaminard, and when might you reach for Foyard with what kind of food, I guess?
Okay. So if you take, for example, the Morgon of Mathieu, which is and we say there is no Cuvée Marcel Lapierre, only the Morgon. We can have it like for a casse-croûte, we say in France, with sausages or a ham, and with some meat dishes. And then Jean is, for example, Jean Foyard have, in a way, much more cuvée. So most of those cuvées stay longer in barrels. So it, in a way, it make just a bit more stronger wines. So you can have it with more cooked dishes, like long time cooked beef or sausage with sauce, I think.
And do you think that you'll stay through the end of this year? And what are your plans? Do you plan to be at Lapierre for a while, or do you plan to do another project? What are you thinking about?
I was thinking, and I'm still thinking, of opening a kind of bistro or auberge in Beaujolais. I really like the area. Maybe also I will try to work in New York. I don't know. I like the country.
They're very similar, Beaujolais and Manhattan. Totally. Okay. Well, Brooklyn, actually, it's not that not that different.
And I'm still owning with my brother a wine company.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. So, but now, in a way, the company is sleeping. But at that time, we buy our locations for the restaurant. That company were stuck the bottles. So two or three possibilities. I don't really know yet.
What do you think the biggest lesson that has struck you from moving from the sell side in terms of selling bottles at a table to working with the vines every day? I mean, what is something that maybe you didn't expect that you've learned along the way?
Working with winemakers is easier than working with some guests. it's true. But in a way, and much more in Beaujolais, drinking wine, it's much more simple. Every winemakers, we often do that, like you move to Jean Foyard Place or Guy Breton, just for having a drink. Jean or Mathieu open bottles from other winemakers. There is a lot of exchange. we most of the time we, you know, we drink it, we give an opinion, but we don't make it like too much intellectual or using too much brain. It's with guests or if you are like too much like a sommelier, you get it's boring. That's what I try to do with winemaker, to say with winemaker, it's you go straight to the point. I like, I don't like because of this, because of that, or the wine is like this or like that. We don't use that much technical words, or because if you use really technical words, you don't understand anything.
Because in a sense, these are farmers that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And what do you think about Matthew as a guy? I mean, your friends, what's he like as a person? I've only met him once.
Oh, no. Yeah, he's really, he used, at the beginning when he was 18, he was a cook. He traveled. He worked also at Alain Chapelle restaurant, my family restaurant. His sister too. They all learned how to be cooked. He traveled. He worked in Canada, in the US, I think, in Paris, and then he came back and say, "I want to work with his father." So he's really involved in food and wine. And in a way, it's how it's supposed to be. All winemakers are keen on food. It's so related. So, very simple. We have a drink and eat. And it's he travels a lot, so he's very involved in, you know, foreign countries and cultural things in foreign countries.
So how long have you been in New York now on this trip?
Since Friday, so 3 days.
And this is your first time to New York?
Yes.
So I have to ask you, how many times have you entered a place and said, my name is Dave Chappelle, and someone has expected a black comedian? Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, no, never.
Well, you still...
I don't know this guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's a famous American comedian. Like,
I will Google
comic.
It.
Yeah. Well, you have 9 more days, so who knows?
Maybe I will meet him.
David Chappelle, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Very much a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Bonsoir.
Salut.
Hey, gang. So you know our show here is sponsored by the wonderful 750, which is a search and find pricing database for wholesale buyers in New York and New Jersey, which we love very much. But we found a few other people who love it, too, one of whom is the fabulous Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, who's here today.
Hey, guys. So I buy for a lot of different random wines, and I love to use 750 because there's a lot of great smaller wholesalers on there that you can take a look at. And as Garth Algar would say from Wayne's World, live in the now. Use 750 because it's great. And it's wonderful for those liquor buyers and wine buyers out there.
Kristen Murphy of the Wine Library, a user of the 750 service. Thank you. All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker, and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.